and teachers, and more cuts to, you know, after school programs, summer programs, professional development for teachers, recruiting and retaining them, lunch programs for students. So it's just, it's devastating. And I know our union is organizing around it, CTA, but I'm just wondering, and I know we're trying to stop the bleeding, and that's good. We have a history of doing that. But I'm just really, really concerned. And like, what else can we do as a community to stop the bleeding and recover and get this funding that our students need back?
On that note, Joe Herman, president of the California Teachers Association, Berryessa, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you, John, and thank you for all your advocacy.
Likewise. This is John Crumshaw for KPFK, now in our fund drive. Pledge online at kpfk.org.
This is Ed Begley Jr., and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. In March of 2025, this year, the U.S. government began a policy of disappearing people to a mega jail in El Salvador called the Terrorism Confinement Center, or CECOT. Young men were in immigration custody when the Trump administration suddenly disappeared them without notification to their attorneys or loved ones. And now, finally, 252 Venezuelans sent from the U.S. to CECOT have been released. And as Rizan Bayen, a scholar, activist, and PhD student in peace studies and history at the University of Notre Dame, writes in her most recent op-ed, quote, "For 6 months, those imprisoned at CECOT in El Salvador were denied core human rights, including the right to due process. Former prisoners said they were subject to cruel and inhumane treatment, including state-sanctioned torture. Though Trump has taken the denial of due process to a further extent than recent administrations, he is justifying his deportation strategy using legal frameworks established by the George W. Bush administration during the so-called War on Terror," end quote. So with us today to talk about how the Trump administration is justifying his deportation strategy using legal frameworks actually established by the George W. Bush administration during the so-called War on Terror is our guest, Rizan Bayen, scholar, activist, and PhD student in peace studies and history at the University of Notre Dame. Importantly, she researches the history and collective memory of state violence against Muslims during the War on Terror. Rizan Bayen, welcome to Middle East in Focus.
Hi, Negwa.
So very, very excited
to be here.
So very excited to have you on the show and to really tap into your expertise and research. It is particularly relevant during this time and is research that I think is something that more and more people need to be tapping into because of how relevant it is to what we're dealing with today and how much not enough people are talking about it in the ways you are. So we're going to dive right in specifically as it relates to the Terrorism Confinement Center. So for those who might not know and who might have even just missed my intro, can you talk about what is the Terrorism Confinement Center in El Salvador and how is it being utilized by the Trump administration?
Right. So CECOT, which is a Spanish acronym that translates to English as the Terrorism Confinement Center, it's a prison in El Salvador, often described as a mega prison or a maximum security prison. It was built in 2022 and opened in 2023 as part of El Salvador's crackdown on gangs in the country, which, interestingly enough, much like the War on Terror here in the U.S., the El Salvador gang crackdown has involved the suspension of certain constitutional rights. But like you said, in March of this year, Trump struck a deal with El Salvador to imprison 252 Venezuelan men in CECOT in exchange for $6 million, essentially paying El Salvador to take the Venezuelan men that he wants deported. These Venezuelan men were arrested under Trump's invocation of a very rarely used wartime policy against the gang that they were accused of being affiliated with, which is Tren de Agua, or TDA. This wartime policy is the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. It allows the president to deport citizens of a country that they are at war with. So what Trump is doing is interpreting TDA as a party that he is at war with. It's a very broad expansion of presidential power. Like you said, the 252 men were recently freed in a prisoner swap, being sent back to Venezuela. But there are a lot of issues with CECOT and how it's being used by the Trump administration. Namely, number one, there's absolutely no contestation of deportation or arrest, which means that these men have their habeas corpus rights being denied. Your habeas corpus rights are essentially your right to contest your arrest in a trial if you are ever arrested. And because these men were just flown to El Salvador, often without even knowing where they were going, not being given a right to a trial, their habeas corpus rights are very explicitly being denied. The other aspect of this is that the whole premise behind the arrest and deportation to CECOT is the fact that supposedly we are at war with TDA, and so these men are affiliated with TDA. Well, the allegations of gang affiliations, that's the entire premise of their arrest, have been very flimsy, with little to no actual evidence tying these men to TDA. Often it's something as little as maybe one of them has a tattoo, or even ICE misplacing their own documents that has landed these men in CECOT.
So could you, if you can, talk a little bit about the court's response to Trump utilizing CECOT to send non-citizens from the United States there? Can you talk about what the court's response has been to that?
I haven't been following that as closely as other aspects of this, but I do believe there are significant challenges to this, yes.
And can you talk about how the Trump administration has been using legal frameworks established by the George W. Bush administration during the so-called war on terror to legally justify sending the 252 Venezuelans from the U.S. to the prison in El Salvador, CECOT?
Yeah, so much like the use of CECOT in Trump's immigration policy, Bush's war on terror also involved a carceral space where prisoners are stuck in a legal black hole. Namely, this is Guantanamo. And for your listeners who might not have been old enough to remember Guantanamo in its prime, it is a prison constructed in a U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where prisoners accused of terrorism post 9/11 were held and tortured. There have been hundreds of men imprisoned, all of them Muslim men, and at the moment, only 15 prisoners remain. In fact, before Trump's use of CECOT, he turned to Guantanamo for his deportations in January of this year, very shortly after his inauguration. In fact, he ordered the immigration facility in Guantanamo to be expanded to hold 30,000 people to be deported there, although he's never gotten anywhere near that number. But what is Bush's legal framework behind the incarceration at Guantanamo? Number one, it's that the president possesses very broad emergency powers during wartime. And remember, they're interpreting 9/11 as an act of war, so we're actively in war. And so during wartime, there are no congressional limits on the president, that he can take any measures within his power to keep the nation safe with little interference from other branches of government. The other aspect of the legal framework of Guantanamo is that certain organizations, namely Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, are not protected under the Geneva Conventions, which are the internationally recognized laws of war. So this means that if you are deemed to be associated with these organizations, even if you are not in actuality associated, your Geneva Convention rights are denied. And then lastly, Guantanamo, as an offshore prison, is deemed to be outside the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. So these men were, again, denied their habeas corpus rights because supposedly they are outside the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. They are not allowed to have a trial in the U.S. court of law to contest their arrest. The result of this legal framework is that war and terror prisoners are held indefinitely in Guantanamo without recourse and tortured without anybody being held accountable for the torture that occurred in Guantanamo. If I hope that I don't have to explicitly point out that this sounds a lot like Trump's deportation policy, because you can see in both cases, men are being taken to a prison outside the U.S. With the sole purpose of infringing on their rights, that they're being tortured, because we know the 252 Venezuelan men are now coming out with allegations about torture in CECOT, that neither of them had access to a trial to contest their arrest, and that, you know, now Trump, as with Bush, is arguing that there is very little limit on the president's power to do these things.
So there's a few things I want to unpack in your response. First, just dealing with the Geneva Convention rights that under the War on Terror legal framework was denied for those who were deemed to be associated with quote-unquote terrorism. Can you first lay out what are some of those Geneva Convention rights?
The most important in the context of Guantanamo is the humane treatment of prisoners of war, so that prisoners of war are not allowed to be tortured when they're interrogated. This is, you know, obviously most important in the context of Guantanamo because a big part of the reason for arguing away the Geneva Conventions is to be able to torture these prisoners with impunity. If you read the legal arguments that Bush's lawyer were making, they were very explicitly listing that if we argue away the Geneva Conventions, we are able to perform enhanced interrogation, which is their word for torture, without being prosecuted by the ICC or by the U.S. War Crimes Act.
So, okay, so now can you lay out in more specificity how this legal framework is being used by Trump for those who are being deported to CECOT? I mean, what are the very specific similarities that we're seeing with respect to those that were being held in Guantanamo and those that are being held in and that were being held and will continue to be held even beyond those who were released? Because it's not like they've stopped this agreement and arrangement with El Salvador and CECOT. What are some of the similarities that you see for those prisoners that were held in Guantanamo and those that were and are going to be in the near future held at CECOT?
Right. So again, it's that they are being very explicitly denied their habeas corpus rights. So they do not have access to a trial where they can contest their arrest. That this very shaky legal sphere that they're operating leaves a very intentional vulnerability to torture. And that the premise of the arrest in both cases is this organizational affiliation that in both cases is carried out on very, very flimsy evidence. In both the case of today with the Venezuelan gang, it does not take very much, as something as little as a tattoo to land you in CECOT. That's enough to say you are part of this gang. That means you are an enemy. It is the same with Guantanamo prisoners. Many of them ended up in Guantanamo simply because they were swept in during mass arrests or they were straight up kidnapped by foreign governments and then sold to the U.S. It was very flimsy pieces of evidence tying them to the organizations that the U.S. had identified as an enemy.
So can you now take it one step further and talk about how, you know, what we saw in Guantanamo, how what we're seeing in CECOT is really just this use of using national security as a way to engage in systemic and institutionalized racism and racial profiling?
Oh, absolutely. The premise of both the War on Terror and the current mass deportation effort in the U.S. The premise behind both of these efforts is that the U.S. is in danger by a certain class of people. And you're absolutely right to point out that it's very racialized. In the case of the War on Terror, it's Muslims, right? It's Arabs or South Asians or whatever, however you want to racialize them. And in the case of immigration, it's primarily Latin American, right? And it's the idea that we are in explicit danger and the way to preserve our national security is to carry out these acts and is to give the president the power to carry out these acts without interference.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking today about how the Trump administration is justifying his deportation strategy using legal frameworks established by the George W. Bush administration during the so-called War on Terror with our guest, Rezan Bayen, scholar, activist, and PhD student in peace studies and history at the University of Notre Dame. She researches the history and collective memory of state violence against Muslims during the War on Terror. So now, Rezan, can you explain who John Yoo is and Alberto Gonzalez, who John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez are, and their relationship to helping establish the War on Terror blueprint for superseding legal processes that the Trump administration is utilizing, as you've discussed, for their deportation strategy?
So John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez are both lawyers. They both worked for the Office of Legal Counsel during the early years of the Bush administration. And in fact, in that time, Gonzalez oversaw the Office of Legal Counsel. For those who don't know, the Office of Legal Counsel acts as the legal advisor to the president. Essentially, if the president has questions about if what he's doing is legal, Office of Legal Counsel will provide them with answers, with their own legal opinions as answers. So following 9/11, when Bush launches the war on terror, he and members of his administration ask the Office of Legal Counsel to draft opinions on how much power the president has, whether the Geneva Conventions apply to this war, and whether Guantanamo prisoners have habeas corpus rights, et cetera, et cetera. The answers they get are in a series of legal opinions, infamously known as the torture memos. And they're referred to as the torture memos because these documents are the legal foundation for the program of torture at Guantanamo. The torture memos, they're written by multiple authors, but the most infamous of them are authored by John Yoo. He is the one that's very explicitly saying, no, these people are not protected under the Geneva Conventions. They don't have habeas corpus rights. You can imprison them indefinitely, and you can torture them, and you can get away with it. While John Yoo is the one that's most explicitly making these arguments, you know, Alberto Gonzalez is also implicated in this. Again, he is the one that actually writes a very interesting memo I referred to earlier to Bush, where he literally lists the pros and cons of denying certain organizations Geneva Convention rights. And like I said, in the pros and cons, in the pros, he states that these legal interpretations will protect us from being prosecuted for wartime war crimes. So not only do these legal opinions go on to become the source of the unlawful imprisonment and torture of hundreds at Guantanamo, but today the things they argued, the expansive presidential wartime power, the denial of habeas corpus rights to certain people based on flimsy claims to their organizational tie, all based on the premise of preserving national security in a very racialized fashion. This is exactly how the Trump administration is running its deportations.
And I think, you know, to my question earlier, and we'll have to do a whole separate show on this. I think why this is so important, everything that you're laying out, and what was essentially, you know, as you and I were even talking before the show, is a form of legalized lawlessness that was established during the Bush administration. It's so important because even though folks are challenging what is happening at CECOT and what the Bush administration, I mean, what the Trump administration is doing with respect to its deportation strategy and sending folks to CECOT, unfortunately, part of what they are able to utilize to legally justify, even in the courts, is this legal framework that you're talking about that
Absolutely.
Was established during the Bush administration. And so
Absolutely.
What I loved about your op-ed is how you call out, honestly, John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez for going on radio shows and trying to somehow make it seem as if what Trump is doing is so different than what they did, and the legal framework that they created to make it even possible for Trump to do this. So now I want to get into that. So what are the arguments that members of Bush's formal legal team, like you and Gonzalez, are currently making to try to distinguish between Trump and Bush's legal approaches? And why are these arguments so misleading?
Yeah, well, first of all, I love that you love that part of my op-ed because it's the entire reason I wrote it, really, really. To be fair, I'm really far from the only one who has noticed these connections between the Bush and the Trump eras. John Yoo and Gonzalez have been doing interviews, and they've been very publicly interviewed and asked about their opinions regarding whether the Trump administration is doing is similar to what they did during their time serving Bush. And their distancing from it really frustrated me and really motivated me to write this op-ed in the first place. What I would say is that without fail, both you and Gonzalez, with their respective interviewers, pointed out when their respective interviewers pointed out the similarities, they responded in a very similar fashion, despite the fact that these were separate interviews, separate instances, separate interviewers. They both responded pretty consistently by creating this distance between their actions and Trump's. John Yoo, he really emphasizes the differences and downplays the similarities. He says that the context of post 9/11 era and now are extremely different, and he even very explicitly calls any similarities between his actions and Trump's as quote unquote superficial. The other argument he makes is that, you know, Bush was actually at war, that 9/11 was an act of war. It put us in a wartime era. It justified Bush's wartime measures, whereas Trump is falsely claiming war, that we're not actually at war with a Venezuelan gang. He's just using that as an excuse to expand his power. What I find misleading about his argument is I don't think Yu offers an explanation as to why it's the differences that are significant and not the similarities. Like, why isn't it the other way around? I would argue that it is the other way around, because to say that Trump is using Yu's legal interpretations as a framework is not the same thing as saying that everything about the two contexts is exactly the same. I think of it as a foundation, not a step-by-step instruction guide. You have something to build off of. You have tactics that are adopted, but they're also adapted according to new contexts, new goals, new obstacles to achieving those goals. And if anything, I find that the differences just go to show that bad faith interpretations of the law just continue to breed bad faith interpretations. The other argument that you brings up is that he only denied habeas corpus rights to those who have never entered the US, right? Like, the whole point of using Guantanamo is to prevent them from having access to US courts. You arrest them outside the US, you imprison them outside the US. They never access US courts. He says that that's legally justified. I've only denied habeas corpus rights to anybody who has never set foot in the US. Trump is explicitly denying habeas corpus rights to those who have entered, and now he's deporting them, and that's wrong. Again, I think my previous argument still stands that it doesn't have to look exactly the same to show an evolutionary relationship. But the other thing about this argument is that the claim is untrue. There was a US citizen who sued John Yoo because he was imprisoned and tortured under Yoo's legal framework, despite, yes, having set foot in the US. With Gonzalez, when he's confronted with this, he argues that the differences that Trump surrounds himself with yes men. He surrounds himself with lawyers that give him whatever answer he wants to hear, and that these are bad faith interpretations of the law, which implies that Gonzalez and the rest of Bush's legal counsel, they were practicing good faith interpretations of the law. He's not the only one to make this argument. There are other lawyers who served under Bush who make this argument. But I think the problem with this one is that I fail to see where the real difference is with the Bush administration. I really do fail to see how the torture memos were not also handing Bush whatever legal opinion he needed to do whatever he wanted. And, I'm not trying to claim that I can read minds, like, God only knows what's in the minds of these people, but I feel like it's a cognitive dissonance. Because Gonzalez, he's very critical of Trump's expansive presidential power. So again, I'm just speculating, but I really almost feel like he's just unable to acknowledge or uncomfortable with the idea that he is in any way partially responsible for Trump's expanded presidential power.
So we have time for my last question that really taps into even just all of your research and work beyond this particular topic. But I'm going to tie it obviously to this topic that we're talking about on today's show. So can you talk about why it's important to understand and raise awareness about how such arguments by Bush's former legal team are misleading? And then, more importantly, both specific to this topic and even beyond, why it's so important for the public to understand that the War on Terror's legal framework actually serves as this foundation for Trump's deportation strategy, but even beyond Trump's deportation strategy, even as it relates to other ways in which the Trump administration is engaged in legalized lawlessness, justifying it under national security?
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons. I think if I had to summarize it, I would say it destroys this collective amnesia that we seem to have, the collective amnesia that I study so firmly, of our history. And destroying that collective amnesia destroys the myth of exceptionality that we seem to have. Like, these scary scenes that we're seeing of people very explicitly being denied their rights, being sent off to God knows where, and being done God knows what to, they're not one-off instances, and we can't act like they are. They did not begin with the Trump presidency. They're not going to end with him. Yes, Trump is responsible for a lot of harm, but at the end of the day, we only look at the individual and we fail to look at the system, then we're failing to understand the real stakes and we make it impossible to do anything about it. I think had the Bush presidency been this exceptional, isolated one-off case, we wouldn't have the Trump presidency today, or the Obama presidency, or the Biden presidency for that matter, because they're both implicated in the war on terror and deportations as well, to be very frank. Had Guantanamo been an exceptional, isolated one-off case, we would not have CECOT, or this Florida prison they're calling Alligator Alcatraz, or hundreds of other prisons that are getting far less coverage. And the fact that they're getting far less coverage is just a reflection of, again, we want to exceptionalize these instances and we don't want to look at the system as a whole. I think when we buy into these arguments, that's what's happening today is exceptional and that it doesn't have a foundation in our history, when we are actively forgetting our history which results in this collective amnesia, which results in future generations not learning about our history, which only serves to reinforce the collective amnesia, then we are refusing to see these incidents as symptoms of a larger system. And it means we'll never be able to dismantle it. We'll just only accept the dominant narrative.
And to your point, and as we're experiencing now, we'll just continue to experience history constantly repeating itself.
Absolutely.
So I want to remind everyone that we have been talking today about how the Trump administration is justifying his deportation strategy using legal frameworks established by the George W. Bush administration during the so-called War on Terror, with our guest Rezén Beyen, scholar, activist, and PhD student in peace studies and history at the University of Notre Dame. She researches the history and collective memory of state violence against Muslims during the War on Terror. Thank you so much, Rezén Beyen, for joining us today, and I look forward to having you back on to have more conversations about your work. Very important work.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
So I just want to take the last few moments that we have for today's show to remind everyone that we are in Fund Drive. Again, the only reason we can even have conversations like the one we had today, like the ones we're having in all of our different programming, is because we are truly independent. That is such a rare thing these days, to be a space where we are not censored by corporate funding, that we are not censored by even government funding, that we are truly able to speak the truth, to present the facts, and really be able to have informed, nuanced conversations about what is really happening, because we are audience sponsored, supported, and because you, the listeners, allow us to exist, both by tuning in and by financially supporting KPFK. And so with that, I really want to encourage all of those who appreciate what we're bringing to the airwaves by calling in, making sure to pledge, donate to help us keep going. It is astounding that we've been around for as long as we have, truly being independent and listener-sponsored. And so I'm going to give you all the phone number. Make sure you call in and you donate because, again, we can only keep going through all of you tuning in and financially supporting us so we can bring you the kind of programming that you all have been asking us to do, continue to ask us to do, and that we are all committed to making sure exists out there, because otherwise we're not hearing these conversations. That number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. I really wanted to take some extra time in our show today to focus in on these pledges. And that's because, you know, for someone who is now a host and producer at KPFK, I really appreciate what goes in to bringing you all programming 24 hours a day that is truly independent. I grew up listening to KPFK, and so it is an incredible honor to be on the other side hosting and producing. And as well as when I'm not hosting and producing along with ST Chandler, my co-host and co-producer, I'm listening too. I'm donating too, because I know that it is through programming that is happening at KPFK that we all are able to have the information we need to not just make informed decisions, but engage in informed activism that is strategic, that is effective, and that is truly going to have the kind of impact that we need, especially in times like these. So again, I want to remind everyone to call in, make your pledge, 818-985-5735. I want to, again, thank all of you, the listeners, for joining us today on Middle East in Focus. The only reason you can hear this show is because you, our audience, support it financially. You are the power of independent radio. We thank you. Hope you will keep listening. Please call in to pledge 818-985-5735. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. I also want to thank our fantastic engineer, Ozzy, and once again, our guest today, Rezen Bayen. Thank you all. Thank you, everyone. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Negwa Ibrahim, wishing you all light, love, and peace. Thanks for joining us, and have a great rest of your Sunday.